Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, the 20th of March, 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Charles Mallett. Welcome to the programme, Charles.
Thank you very much.
And by video link from Damascus, Vanessa Bailey. We're going to get started with this man, the former King of England, as we used to call him, Mark Sedwill. Now, many people will have forgotten who he is, but at one point he was head of the civil service, amongst other things. So let's just remind ourselves the kind of role that he had at this time, which is why we dubbed him the King of England and put him on the throne. That was, you know, he was effectively in charge of Foreign Office, Ministry of Defence, Human Intelligence, Military Intelligence, DCHQ, and so on, this whole range of things, Joint Intelligence Community, Committee, COBRA, all went into him as head of the Home Civil Service, National Security Advisor, and head of the Cabinet Office. He was basically in charge of everything. Now, he then went on, following leaving that role, to head up the Atlantic Future Forum, which is all about the transatlantic alliance and so on with respect to defence and security. Well, he is one of the authors of a new report from this organisation, the New Bletchley Network, as they call themselves. So let's just look at the key people that are on this author's list for this report. This is report number 9 from this lot, and Lord Robertson, the former head of NATO, General Sir Richard Barons, Nigel Hall, he established the New Bletchley Network, former military officer, Lord David Richards, former Chief of the Defence Staff, I think, yep. Richard Sheriff, and Mark Sedwill are the 5 names out of the group that I chose because they were the ones that jumped out at me. So let's just look at some of the text that they have produced as part of this report. So here we are, we'll start off with this. We must signal to adversaries and potential adversaries the fact that we are strong, that's Britain they're talking about, and want to get stronger, whilst at the same time having no interest in attacking or subverting any non-aggressive city or country. So I'm not quite sure what the definition of a non-aggressive city or country is. Let's go on with it. They want to deter and prevent, war. We need a credible new model army. And they put new model army with capital N, M and A. And this is the acronym is NMA in the rest of the report. So they want a credible new model army, an exemplar and widely respected ready to go war, land force and reserves. And I find it, Charles, fascinating that they are choosing to use that term. Of course, they are invoking, the Civil War at this point and the new model army. Involved conscription. So are they perhaps hinting in that direction? I don't know. Any thoughts?
Well, I think very much hinting in that direction. I think it harks back to a time of incredible turmoil. And also there's this continual sort of recycling of old terminology with Bletchley and the new model army, which just is very discordant with the continual push for innovation and all things being new and futuristic. It does seem to jar with that as well. It's most strange.
Very strange. So let's go on with it then. They go on to say, to be credible in deterrence terms, we need to prepare genuinely for war and communicate this to potential foes, NATO and allies, and particularly to the British public. So they're very concerned that the propaganda continues. We need to consider streamlining and reconfiguring our Whitehall top security architecture and subordinate headquarters. We need war-ready, whole-of-nation, new command and control arrangements, and realign responsibility, accountability, authority, and budgetary chains. And they say the new model regular army and reserves must reconnect across our communities. They should become the go-to career choice for Generation Z and Alpha based upon outstanding training, education, skills, opportunities, and exciting lived experience, never mind the death, destruction, and the rest that goes with it if we're preparing for a war. Delivering all this, turning around 30 years of decline and producing an exemplar NMA demands a concerted campaign. It probably requires an overarching COVID vaccine-style task force approach if it's to be delivered in time. Vanessa, let me welcome you to the programme and ask, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, for me, it's quite interesting. What pops out to me is exemplar, which is very reminiscent of Templar, of course. An odd usage of that terminology twice in two paragraphs. but maybe I'm just being making too many connections, but it does seem quite interesting to me.
I don't really know. I mean, what are the Russians supposed to make of this? This just looks like insanity to me. But anyway, what else has been going on around defense and sanctions?
Yeah, sanctions in particular. Good afternoon, everybody. We're constantly being reminded how tough the United Kingdom is when it comes to fighting against the authoritarianism of Putin and Russia. The House of Commons Library has produced a briefing paper with detail about sanctions against Russia and why do we do it. They're considered to be a useful foreign policy tool. They're restrictive measures intended to be temporary that can be used to force change in behaviour, constrain a country's actions, or to communicate a political message to other countries and individuals. So I thought we'd examine exactly how they do change behaviour. And we're able to look at this through the details provided by the Department for Business and Trade. But before we go into that, we'll just look at the map, because this has been touched upon in the mainstream, but I think not enough inferences have been drawn. I've got arrows on a map here showing the western and southern parts of Russia and the countries that border Russia, particularly Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Kazakhstan. So what we're going to do is really follow a story that's to do with the sanctions that have been implemented against Russia. And I draw your attention to the fact that £9.8 billion, which is the figure that's not being traded with Russia, is roughly equivalent to the commitment for the defence budget to Ukraine. So that's sort of worthy of significance. But really to highlight that where exports haven't been made to Russia, they must, of course, have gone somewhere else. Now, highlighted in the mainstream media is the enormous rise of imports in cars to Azerbaijan. We see for the last quarter an increase of 28.7% to Azerbaijan, and we see that cars total 58.2% of goods to Azerbaijan. Is this a one-off? Kazakhstan, an increase of 89.2% in the last quarter, with cars listed as 24.6 million or 6.8% of that. Georgia, too, an increase of 26% and cars forming 21% of that. Estonia, an increase of 11%, more moderate, cars 15% of that, £50 million. And Finland, accounting for 6.9% increase, with cars at 5.8% or £85 million. Obviously, closer to home, more realistic that they would have had an existing conduit there. And then finally, Latvia, again, a moderate increase of 5.2%, but cars up, at around £34 million or 8.9%. So it's obvious, in a way, if one is to eliminate the possibility of coincidence, that whilst cars aren't being exported directly to Russia, they are, of course, going into Russia, most likely over the border from these countries that do import in such large quantities now. So it looks like a gigantic book cooking exercise to make it look like sanctions do actually do something, to be able to continually talk tough. And this, of course, relates back to Mike's previous segment on the steps being made towards a war footing. But of course, what is it that the industry and the government are saying about the cars themselves? So we'll have a quick look at where we're supposed to be going on this path to zero emissions. We've got the declaration from September last year about 80% of new cars and 70% of new vans to be at zero emissions, whatever exactly that means, by 2030. And the detail from that sets a minimum annual target, starting with a requirement for 22% of new cars sold in 2024 to be zero emission. Now, what they don't specify here is who those cars are to be sold to, or indeed where. And we go on to the Society for Motor Manufacturers and Traders, who have a publication, a monthly publication, and they've got statistics from January in which they confirm that the bulk of production this month, which has gone up dramatically, was for export. So nearly 80% going for export. Overseas shipments up 11.6%. Of course, they're at pains to suggest that these increases really have only been affected in terms of the trade with the US, China, and Japan and Australia. But I think we can extrapolate from that that the figures we've looked at confirm that there have been significant increases elsewhere, particularly on the borders with Russia. And again, they go on to say that on the electrical vehicle side of it, UK production of battery electric, plug-in hybrid and hybrid vehicles rose again by a combined 4.5% to account for 35.7% of overall output. So therefore, that suggests that it's well above the government target. However, in line with overall figures, the majority of these models were exported. So this is the government putting forward the argument not only that we are winning against Putin economically because we are imposing these sanctions and continually modifying them, but also that we're winning in terms of electric vehicles and indeed vehicle production. And in actual fact, none of those things is true.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Charles. Now, Vanessa, let's welcome you back to the program. And last week we were talking about Oracle and the relationship between Oracle and Israel. This week we want to have a look at the UK-Israel Tech Hub.
Yes, spending more time down the bunny labyrinth of Israeli or Zionist influence over sectors of British society, pretty much all sectors. Rather than me reading off the screen, let's play the video, which is a promo video of this UK-Israel Tech Hub based in Tel Aviv at the British Embassy. Interesting, this video was put out just before the COVID project kicked off. I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions. So let's play the video. Truly awful music. I don't know who picked that. But anyway, so one of the services of the UK-Israel Tech Hub is to organize bespoke business delegations. And in 2022, they organized a health tech delegation to Israel. So let's just play a few seconds of their kind of promo video of that event. So interesting that they appear to be focusing very much on the Midlands and the north of the UK. And here is a screenshot from that video, and you'll see on there are included Manchester University, Leeds University, and Sheffield University. So it would be quite interesting to speak to some of these so-called partners of the Israel tech sectors or ecosystem to see exactly what level of collaboration is there. Now, this was mentioned in the media on their website. More than 300 Israeli companies have already a presence in the UK. I would say now it's closer to 400. And one in seven NHS drugs it comes from Israel. Now, then again, on this video, let's look at the partners. So you have there the NHS. Of course, you have AstraZeneca, sort of blaringly in the right-hand corner, and a number of other fairly well-known organizations within the British government who works with the UK-Israel Tech Hub. On the next slide, we can see. So you have basically the Department of Digital, Culture, Media and Sport, the Foreign and Commonwealth Development Office, Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. Now, also a little reminder that about 2 weeks ago, we looked at the influence of Unit 8200. So bearing in mind that this is literally a tech hub, a reminder that the best tech school on earth is the Israeli Army spy unit, 8200. Israel's unit, 8200, a conveyor belt of high-tech startups. So to what degree does the 8200 unit have influence also over these partnerships? Now, you had previously, or you still have currently, sorry, the UK Israel business. The organization has a network of over 2,000 companies and 10,000 business leaders and works closely with the Department for International Trade, the British Embassy in Tel Aviv, the Israeli Embassy in London, and the UK-Israel Tech Hub. Now, interestingly, this was founded in 1950 as the Anglo-Israel Chamber of Commerce. So 2 years after the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the Nakba in 1948, when Palestinians possessed of their land. In 2011, it merged with the Israel-Britain Business Council, the IBBC, and became the UKIB. Yes, it all does get very confusing. The chairman of this one, the UKIB, Danny Kessler, a dedicated supporter of nonprofit organizations and charities, is a corporate trustee of the Anglo-Israel Association, another one. His family's involvement in the creation of the State of Israel has instilled in him a passion for Israel's growth in all areas, and he sits on the board of several such organizations. And then we have, Dan Beshadsky, Dor Beshadsky, who's the executive director. He holds degrees from the Hebrew University, served as a team commander in the IDF Special Forces, and at UKIB, he has expanded the organization's focus on executive programs. So again, you have this very heavy Israeli military influence on these organizations and groups. And then honorary president Trevor Chin. Who is Trevor Chin, you might ask? Well, this was, I think it was 2 years ago, 22. Secret document reveals Israel lobby's dominance of labor. Multimillionaire Trevor Chin secretly funded Starmer's leadership campaign earlier in 2020 and has a long history of financing pro-Israel groups in both main parties of government. His pledges included, that's Reid's pledges. So that was Reid's pledges to Chin, included committing labor to opposing BDS, the Palestinian-led boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, as well as promoting the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's working definition of anti-Semitism. But who else does Trevor Chin get involved with? So there you can see very clearly the Israel-Britain Business Council, the IBBC, as we mentioned. He's a member of the Executive Committee of BICOM. This is interesting. You can look him up. You can find out all of the other Zionist lobbies that he is a member of, president of, on the committee of, etc. It's very easy. But what is BICOM? So according to a Guardian article in 2009, how the pro-Israel lobby in Britain benefits from a generous London tycoon. Britain's most active pro-Israeli lobbying organization, which is the British Israel Communications and Research, BICOM, which flies journalists to Israel on fact-finding trips, I would read propaganda, and organizes access to senior government figures, has received nearly $1.4 million in 2 years from a billionaire donor whose father made a fortune manufacturing arms in Israel. And BICOM is known basically for influencing media, government officials, etc. This is from a slide that Brian put on the news back in November 2023. Which shows very clearly the billionaire donor to BICOM and to Cameron in this case is Pezhu Zebludovich, who's a Finnish Israeli. Thank you. industrialist and arms dealer, as was his father before him. And you can see there, 2 million has gone to Vicom. Vicom is making donations to the Conservative. Vicom is also making donations to the Conservative Friends of Israel. And you can see that this is an entire merry-go-round of both money laundering and donations and sponsorship of political opinion, in my opinion. Then let's look at the Vicom team. So in the management director of Vicom, Richard Pater, 15 years basically influencing government officials, diplomats, and journalists. He regularly briefs British audiences on Israeli politics and security. Read into that what you will. He regularly appears on the BBC. He's responsible for UK delegations to Israel. He joined from Israel's Prime Minister's office, and he also served in the IDF Armored Brigade and continues to serve even now in the reserves. And let's have a look at some of the researchers. I'll focus on Caleb Bandor on the right. He is basically living in Israel since 2005, pre-BICOM. He was policy planning. He was in the policy planning division of Israel's foreign ministry. And pre-2005, he was in the public affairs department at the Israeli embassy in London. And then moving on, we can see that basically the UK-Israel tech hub is still alive and kicking in January 2024, so in the midst of the war. And this was an interview with Tajel Yanov, the strategic partnerships and critical tech lead at the UK-Israel tech hub. And basically what she says, with UK elections looming, she doesn't think it will make any difference to the relationship between Israel and particularly the UK-Israel tech hub. Whichever party is in power, they will continue to promote, support, and expand the partnership and collaboration with Israel. And I'd just like to leave you with a quote from Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1938, his message to the Congress on curbing monopolies. The first truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism. Ownership of government by an individual or a group or by any other controlling private power for discussion. But I think, Mike, one point that I really do want to make is, to what extent does this collaboration freeze out UK startups and UK tech development? So in other words, indigenous tech development, right? And to what degree do those companies and organizations that take part in this collaborative exercise have to align themselves with British foreign policy and Israeli policy in order to get a look in to these partnerships and collaborative exercises and projects?
Yes, that's a very good point, a very good question. We'll discuss that a little bit more in extra. And also the other question that needs to be asked, Vanessa, is this a takeover of British tech by Israel, or is this in fact the inevitable payoff for Israel continuing to pursue our foreign policy in the region?
Yeah, I mean, that is a good question, and it definitely needs discussion.
Okay, well, we'll have a chat about that in extra. So thank you very much for that, Vanessa. Okay, if you like what the UK Column does and you'd like to support us, please head over to support.ukcolumn.org. All the options for helping us out are there. And it's only through your financial support that we can continue doing what we do. You could pick something up at the UK Column shop. But please do share anything you find on the various platforms, especially on ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. Now, at 1 p.m. yesterday, Brian's interview with Madeleine Hunt went out. She is looking at councils and the title of this was The Twilight of Democracy in UK Councils. So councils and so on, very much a feature of what she was talking about. If you're interested in that area and council policy, then have a look at that interview. Tomorrow, Joy Warren is the guest for an interview, and she is going to be talking about fluoride fluoride in our water and the whole principle of mass medication of populations. Finally, then, I just want to mention this. The UKCV family has now established itself as a proper charity. These, of course, are a group of quite a number of vaccine injured. So they describe themselves as a friendly UK-based community of individuals that unfortunately experienced life-changing adverse reactions after receiving COVID-19 vaccines. So you can find out more about this group at ukcvfamily.org. Please do have a look at that and support them if you possibly can. Many of the people that are involved in that are extremely ill still and don't see any prospect of improvement in their situation. They're certainly not getting any support from the mainstream media or from the UK government, and certainly not from the MHRA or the industry. So they do need support and help to promote their work. They are working very hard in extremely trying circumstances. Okay, let's move on then. And where is this? The Shaping the Future conference.
Yes, which I'll come to in just a second. But we hear so much now about artificial intelligence and the way that we're being pushed and all relating to sort of innovation. So I thought we'd just have a closer look at education, because on the 18th Monday, there was a conference in Manchester, Next Generation Assessment. And in effect, this was, or at least part of it, was an examination of the use of artificial intelligence, not so much in the sphere of education itself, but more in terms of assessment. And there are just a few points, I think, that are worth making around this. So we see that one of the breakout sessions was conversations around AI and assessment. And we highlighted text here, looking at the potential for AI to radically change the status quo. So that's just put out there rather starkly, without any real justification of the benefits or otherwise of radical change. So we see again, breakout session F, explore the benefits of digital exams for students and teachers, as well as what it will take to make it a reality. So we see this a lot now, really, the unchallenged way in which technology is just put forward as the answer without any real justification. And it looks an awful lot like change is being mistaken for progress. We look back at Gillian Keegan's press release back in January of this year, speaking at the BET Show 2024. And again, she reinforces the message. She says, "Today we're publishing our latest research on AI and education, having brought together views from our world-leading experts and educators. I want to encourage countries to continue sharing evidence as it's generated so that we can all better harness the opportunities to make a real difference in classrooms across the world." So again, an unqualified assertion that difference in some way is good. What I thought we'd do, therefore, is have a quick look at some of the, well, a couple of independent schools that are in the top rankings by Ofsted, the first being St. Paul's Girls' School, which have developed a sort of an AI contraption, for want of a better word, called iPaulina. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but nonetheless, they, in their sort of explanation of what it does, they ask this question: if a machine or an application is generating the answer to all the tasks that are assigned to students, does it really benefit the students themselves? And rather staggeringly, the answer is yes. The solution to whatever has been assigned to them is right there in front of them, but it isn't building up the pupils' knowledge itself or helping them realise their potential and abilities. So should this actually be classed as education or laziness? Well, that's an extremely good question, which they don't, of course, go on to answer. But at first glance, it looks very much like it strips away any necessity for critical thinking. And also, the other thing is the inherent bias that might be put into any of these systems. So we'll look at another example here. This is from Eton College, who've sort of put forward a hypothesis for the future in which they talk about a typical school day in 2028. It doesn't seem to be a school day at Eton. The child featured is a girl, whilst Eton remains an all-boys school. But it talks about her attending a secondary school in the UK, and artificial intelligence tools form part of almost every lesson and subject. These changes have rolled out across all levels of education, including state and independent sectors. And then they go on. The AIs are all aware of these questions, the teacher having prompted them before the lesson, and they have been instructed not to directly answer them, but rather guide the students to piece together the answers themselves. So what exactly is a teacher supposed to be doing? But further detail here, and this is where I believe it gets rather ridiculous. They talk about having a physics lesson, they're learning about gravity. So to start the lesson, the teacher invites everyone to chat with Isaac Newton via their tablets and ask him what people used to think about gravity when he was young. The students in the class all start to speak to their tablets, and a simulacrum of Isaac Newton on their screens responds to their questions. Well, we'll come back to exactly where that could go in a minute, but just let's suppose that they start to ask about things that aren't directly related to gravity. And then finally, they go on, and again, they address this bias. Today, the class is studying how the face recognition algorithms of the same era were deeply flawed. This is talking about going back to a sort of decade or so ago, being over 100 times more accurate at recognizing light-skinned males compared to dark-skinned males. So how's this going to be dealt with? And is there any suggestion that overcompensation might have played a part in this? And if we think about what Newton might have said on other topics, this is where this slide becomes relevant. There's an example here from Adobe Firefly on the left and Gemini, both AI products available at the moment.
Gemini being Google's product.
Yes, Gemini, absolutely, being Google's new AI product. But you can see here that, or at least if you're listening and not watching, but essentially it's represented an awful lot of people who were certainly not black or Asian or of any color other than being white, have been inserted into history in places that they simply weren't. So returning to the idea that education could be enhanced by this, or indeed that this would lead people towards critical thinking or away from indoctrination, seems extremely far-fetched and effectively set up for a massive failure. So on the theme of failure, and linked perhaps indirectly, we just going to have a quick look at what happened in Sainsbury's and, in fact, Tesco last weekend, March the 16th. A tweet here: due to an error with an overnight software update, we're experiencing issues with contactless payment and will not be able to deliver the vast majority of today's groceries online orders. The stores are open as usual, accepting chip and PIN and cash payments. They put another tweet out that same day saying that they're unable to contact customers directly, but the online ordering system is working properly and all the rest of it. The Sun newspaper followed this up with an illustration of how the smart shop capability in effect completely collapsed. And really, the purpose of selecting this story is not just to poke fun at Sainsbury's, rather more it's to make the serious point that companies across the spectrum are seeking to put people in a position where they trust some system that's labelled as being smart, and this goes right up to digital currency, digital identity. And it's examples like this that demonstrate how quickly and how easily the entire system is rendered completely and utterly incapable. And of course, the only thing to fall back on are the existing tried and trusted measures such as, say, cash and indeed the previously existing card technology. So really, it's just another illustration of much vaunted sort of technological progression in the name of progress. But of course, actually, really, it's just change, not necessarily for the good. However, we are going to continue to have it rammed down our throats. And you might be aware that the BBC have sort of revamped their website. So this is the way that the tabs fall now when you select innovation. And it's just interesting to see that under innovation, not only do we see artificial intelligence, we also see health, science and health, under innovation. So this is definitely not going away. And Mike, I mean, I'm sure you've got lots of thoughts on this. It's something that I know you've very closely followed.
We will talk much more about this in extra. My first question to you, Charles, was on your comment about Eton being a boys' school. Is that still the case?
Well,
because of course, you know, it's really up to the boys what they are these days.
I misspoke. That is a very, very good point. And after all, they were talking about 2028, and who knows? I mean, you might be able to choose the year by then. It could be any year. We'll see.
Indeed. Okay. Now, I have really been not wanting to cover this topic. And I'm going to say we're not going to be talking really about Kate Middleton here. So stick with me until I get to the point. But we need to start off just by bringing her on and reminding everybody that a few weeks ago, We saw, or a week or two ago, we saw this image appearing in all the various mainstream headlines. Kate Middleton spotted for the first time after surgery, and wild conspiracy theories in new photos. And the photo appeared, which didn't look very much like her. And of course, lots of people were saying that this wasn't her on social media. Then, of course, we had the whole furore over the photograph that she allegedly took of herself, the prince took of her and her children. And this turned out to be photoshopped and was removed by all the various agencies. And of course, this absolutely inflamed the discussion online and so on. And then a couple of days ago, we saw a video clip appearing in The Sun, apparently claimed to be showing her, Princess Kate, seen on video for the first time since surgery, looking happy and relaxed on shopping trip with William. And most people seem to be in agreement that this doesn't look anything like her, and they are absolutely disputing that it is her. Now, what has the result of all this been? Because at each stage along the line of this, bearing in mind that there's been mainstream media that has been pushing this narrative, what has happened is that it has inflamed social media, particularly Twitter and TikTok, absolutely inflamed them with huge amounts of discussion about it and so on, and all kinds of claims of it not being her and all this kind of thing. Now, I'm not going to comment on that. I'm interested here on what the mainstream media has done. And of course, as you would expect, the lovely Mariana Spring turfs up to the BBC this morning, or last night actually was when they originally published it, how Kate's body double conspiracy theory spread on social media. And, you know, this whole issue of whether the person in that photograph is Kate Middleton or not is very interesting, because let's just look at a little bit of the text from this article, because Mariana Spring says, I messaged dozens of TikTokers posting these videos throughout the world, many of whom were zooming in and analysing the Princess of Wales facial features and comparing them with those in pictures of the lookalike. You'll note that it's not in pictures of the alleged lookalike or the claimed lookalike. It is definitive, the pictures of the lookalike. So is this just bad journalism by Mariana Spring, or has she let something slip here? I'm not clear. But anyway, let's go on with it, because the next thing that we need to mention, of course, is that the BBC has been absolutely driving the narrative that what's going on with Kate Middleton at the moment is very similar to what happened with Princess Diana. And of course, the press and the media very much vilified for what happened with Princess Diana. But now it's social media that's being vilified for what's happening with Kate Middleton. And so they had Diana's brother, Earl Spencer, on with Laura Kunzberg on Sunday. And then this morning, the news hit, it was claimed to be an exclusive by the Mirror, that somebody has perhaps driven by all this appalling behaviour on social media, has decided that they needed to try to find out what is really going on with Kate Middleton. And so there's been a security breach at the hospital that she was at, the London Clinic, and that somebody, a member of hospital staff, or more than one member of hospital staff, attempted to view private medical records. So what's this all about? Well, of course, what it is actually all about is censorship. And so, for example, we had this from the Joint Committee on National Security talking about Ofcom, the Electoral Commission, this whole narrative of defending democracy, which is running in parallel at the same time as the UK approaches a general election, and how social media is such an appalling thing, an appalling risk for democracy at the moment, and so on. Now, what I'm saying here is that what we're witnessing is a psychological operation, that the mainstream press are doing things which are designed to instill a reaction in the general public. That reaction appears on social media, and that therefore justifies claims that social media needs to be much heavier regulated, much more heavily regulated, sorry. Well, let's just not forget that this country absolutely has precedent for this, and remind everybody that in March 2020, the Spy B, SAGE subgroup, were absolutely promoting the idea of the mainstream media exploiting fear in order to drive adherence to social media, to social distancing measures that the government was trying to push in at the time. So kind of in parallel with that then, a couple of weeks ago, we had this article from Politico. US tech giants refuse to work with Britain's top secret military censorship board. Now, what is this top secret military censorship board that they're talking about? Well, this is the DSMA. And of course, this is the organization that pushes forward D notices. Now, DSMA Notice 1, a D Notice 1 is a notice which aims to prevent the inadvertent disclosure of information which would improve an adversary's knowledge and understanding of the UK's military plans, current operations and capabilities. And basically, this is supposedly a voluntary scheme that the mainstream media is involved with. And as soon as a D Notice is issued, they voluntarily choose to self-censor in order to make sure that whatever the topic was that they were going to cover isn't covered. And it's really up to this organization, the DSMA, whether those notices are issued. But anyway, getting back to the Politico article here, this is what they had to say. Britain's media censorship board is trying to woo big tech, but the Silicon Valley giants just aren't interested. Tech firms including Google, Meta and X have repeatedly spurned the secretive British committee in its mission to prevent state secrets spreading across social platforms. And they quote Jeffrey Dodds as saying, we've been trying to break into the so-called tech giants. He's the DSMA notice secretary and former military diplomat, as they describe it. And he said that Meta and Google were among those that had been reached out to. Now, Google has already been, as they highlight, a member of the DSMA committee, but they left following Edward Snowden's revelations, and the DSMA hasn't been able to get them back on board since. And the quote from the article says, Google felt they were unable to sit on a committee which is independent, voluntary, non-statutory, but nevertheless, they felt they couldn't sit on it because it was too linked to government. Well, I think that's absolutely true. But I think what we've got here is now a multi-pronged, real serious concerted effort to demonize everything that's happening on social media. And the rather pathetic story of Kate Middleton, which, let's face it, if she was up and about and walking at a garden centre or whatever it was the other day, she could very quickly, in a matter of 30 seconds, produce a little video saying thank you to all her friends and all the public for supporting her at this time. But that's not coming. All we've got in the meantime is speculation and the driving of this furore on social media. In fact, if we get involved in that discussion, we're falling for the trap, in my opinion. Let's move on then, and Scotland and land.
Indeed. We've covered a lot on the environmental schemes that are either being put out as proposals or indeed have met reality in England and Wales. So now a focus on Scotland with the Land Reform Bill dated 14th of March 2024. And in effect, this highlights really how devolution can affect itself, which is essentially that destination is the same, but the language used with which to get there is slightly different. So the bill here places legal responsibilities on the owners of the very largest landholdings to show how they use their land and how that use contributes to key public policy priorities, such as addressing climate change and protecting and restoring nature. These owners will also have to engage with local communities about how they use the land. So I'm not going to go too much further into the bill, which obviously is a bill at the moment. But in effect, the way that the Scots are aiming to do this is actually slightly different. And by remarkable coincidence, there is a campaign launched at almost exactly the same time by Community Land Scotland, saying that they're calling on the Scottish Government to commit to ensuring 10% of Scotland's land to be community-owned by 2030 through urgent and ambitious land reform and by working with local communities for a more just and greener Scotland. And this is their sort of recurring theme. It's just a few bits from their website. Scotland's for sale, but who is buying it? And then they talk about helping communities realise the benefits of community ownership. To be fair to them, on Twitter, they have highlighted some of the inconsistencies in environmental policy. They talk about that carbon offsetting undermining the need to reduce direct carbon emissions, if one puts to one side the entirely flawed scientific concept there. But they make the point that allowing people who are polluting, such as Shell and fails, to maintain business as usual and keep polluting, when it means that some other activity has got to be done somewhere else to offset this, is of course ludicrous, as is the planting of non-native trees. So this is what they're dealing with on the left on the impacts. But then they I would say they perhaps overstep on the right with what can be done, because they talk about changing how the economy works through decarbonizing it, dismantling systems of injustice, encouraging wealthy individuals and corporations to buy land, plant trees with public money and profit from Scotland's extremely unequal land ownership will not solve the climate crisis, but entrench the systems that caused it. They don't qualify that exactly, but they do go on to say, when communities own their own land, net zero targets, sustainability of local livelihoods and caring for biodiversity can all be centred rather than prioritising profit from the land. Well, it's interesting, of course, when one considers how the various lures being offered to English and Welsh farmers are manifesting themselves. So Scotland's issue seems to be that the vast majority of the land is in the hands of a very small number of landowners, which is something that's been a recurring theme over many years. So where has this come from? We go back to 2014, the land of Scotland and the common good. So now the language that we see here is starting to make sense in what really seems in some ways to be a sort of either communist or at least sort of communitarianist approach. Again, 2014 language. The largest private landowner in Scotland at present is Buccleuch Estates, with nearly 100,000 hectares, or just over 1% of Scotland's land area. The concern is not what an upper limit should be, but the principle that there should be an established limit. Now, that's out of date because the largest landowner in Scotland is now a Scandinavian. But nevertheless, of course, the significant detail here is that this has not come from Scotland. It's come from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization's voluntary guidelines on responsible governance of tenure, and it includes the provision that states may consider land ceilings as a policy option. These guidelines are supported by, amongst others, the G20 group of states, including the UK. So we just go back a little bit further to 2012 to see exactly what we are referring to here, which, as stated, are the voluntary guidelines on responsible governance of tenure. So the idea here is really that although in the first instance this was introduced as being entirely voluntary, of course it's weaved its way into proposed legislation to suggest that it must go ahead. And indeed, it's interesting to see how government in this case seems to be working alongside a pressure group to take land away from people who are deemed to have too much of it.
Mm. Okay, well, we're going to move back to the Middle East. Before we do that, we're going to go to the House of Commons. And here is a tweet from Andy MacDonald, MP. And it says, Tory Minister Andrew Mitchell tells me I should be comforted by the ideas of lawyers being embedded in Israeli armed units. Let's just have a look at this a little bit of video.
To any reasonable and informed observer, the conduct of the war in Gaza by Israel contravenes basic international humanitarian law in failing to distinguish between armed combatants and civilians and using force beyond what is militarily necessary, offends against the prohibition of inflicting unnecessary injury, and is wholly disproportionate. Over 100,000 Palestinians have now been killed or injured by Israeli forces in Gaza since last October. So whilst the Minister relies on Israel being a democracy capable of abiding by its legal obligations, when the overwhelming evidence is that it is not doing so, what legal advice has he received about the complicity of and the dangers to our country of failing to take sufficient action under the relevant treaties to which this country is a signatory to deter such gross breaches of international humanitarian law?
Minister. Well, as I said, Mr. Speaker, we do continue to assess Israel's commitment and capability to comply with international humanitarian law. Those assessments are supported by a detailed evidence base, conflict analysis, reporting from charities and NGOs, international bodies and partner countries, statements and reports by the Israeli government and their track record of compliance. And we take all of that into account in making the judgments we make. But I would point out to him that when it comes to targeting, when it comes to military action, the Israeli Defence Force has its own lawyers embedded in those units and in in much the same way of prudence that the British military do. That is not something which you see in any other force in the region, and it should give some confidence that they are seeking to abide by international humanitarian law.
Okay, so before we get Vanessa's thoughts on that comment that he's made, what is the situation with lawyers in the British military,
Charles? Well, unless things have changed very drastically, in some senses, he's correct in that Army Legal Services would provide personnel, forward personnel, but into perhaps a divisional or brigade headquarters. But the idea that they're going any further forward than that is, I'm afraid, ludicrous. And also, to suggest that they would be able to influence the decisions of more junior commanders. I mean, first of all, there simply aren't enough of them. So I'm afraid what Andrew Mitchell says does not stack up in any way at all.
Yeah, Vanessa, that's the British situation. What's your thoughts on what he said about the IDF and lawyers?
I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. In that kind of fighting environment in Gaza, lawyers or not, they will be carrying weapons and they will be partaking in the crimes that the IOF are committing against civilians that are being recorded on an almost minute-by-minute basis. So, I mean, yes, it's entirely ludicrous. It also harks back to this idea that Israel is capable of investigating its own crimes against humanity. Has he not read the 84-page report by South Africa or even followed on social media? I presume he's modern enough to be able to do that. The thousands of videos demonstrating the IOF sadistic measures taken against Gazan children, civilians, medical staff, etc.
Thank you for that. Now, just bring us up to date what's been going on with Shifa Hospital.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, that's interesting following on from what we've just been talking about, because I wanted to demonstrate how BICOM, the British Israel Communications and Research Organization, packed full of former IDF and Zionist lobby influencers, actually reports on what is going on in the war. And the most recent sort of big event is the fourth siege and attack on Shifa Hospital in sort of central northern Gaza. And so I want to see how BICOM put it out. And bear in mind, they claim that they have huge influence. The Guardian claimed in 2009 that they are one of the biggest influences in the UK on the opinions of media, including the BBC, on government officials, even MPs like Andrew Mitchell there. And so let's just have a look. So they basically channel the IDF spokesperson, Hogari, who's claiming that the IDF is operating in compliance with international law and against the Hamas terrorist organization. A claim again that Hamas is operating out of hospitals, which has been debunked on the third previous occasions, and using civilian infrastructure in a systematic, cynical pattern of behavior, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, BICOM channels the IDF, nothing else. They claim that an operation was planned several days ago to basically assassinate senior terrorists, meaning Hamas resistance members. But let's have a look how Mondo Vice, again, let's say an anti-Zionist regime Israeli media outlet, who talk about the real reason that Israel stormed Al-Shifa Hospital yet again. So let's have a look at what they tell us, which is very different. So the assassination was of Faik al-Mahbou, who was the director of operations of the Gaza police force, nothing to do with Hamas terrorist forces. And in reality, he was in charge of the distribution of humanitarian aid that was being brought into Shifa Hospital, into UNRWA centers surrounding Shifa Hospital. And he managed to actually deliver a fair amount of humanitarian aid to northern Gaza that is basically enduring real famine conditions through the lack of delivery of humanitarian aid by Israel and by Egypt. So basically, they wanted to assassinate him. Now, why did they want to do this? What the IOF is trying to achieve inside Gaza, if we look at the final slide on what Mondovice basically point out, and this is in line with what I'm hearing. Basically, the Israeli forces have been civil society, all police, security forces. Today in Nusayr camp, which is on the western coast, they assassinated another director of police forces and security forces there. So they're trying to create an environment of societal disorder in the hope that tribal factions will take hold and will create a fragmented Gaza that is easier for the Israeli alliance to control. So as Mondavis says, in foiling Mahbub's pivotal role in coordinating the delivery of humanitarian aid to starving civilians in Gaza while restoring a semblance of social order to the north. In other words, the attack on al-Shifa was an assassination operation aimed at breaking down civil order. It aimed to facilitate Israel's genocidal project and pave the way for total control over the area without resistance. The unfolding events of the past few days expose Israel's intention of engineering famine and contributing to social breakdown. It reminds us that this is not only a war against Gaza's resistance, but also against its people.
Yes, thank you, Vanessa. Thanks very much for that. Now, let's just end on this report from the National Audit Office on immigration and the cost of hosting immigrants in the UK. They're saying £1.2 billion, the cost of the Home Office large site scheme to house asylum seekers, and that is going to be more expensive than the cost of keeping asylum seekers in hotels. So this was their conclusion. The Home Office has made progress in its plan to reduce the use of hotels to accommodate people seeking asylum, but in rapidly progressing its plans to establish large sites, it has incurred negatory spending and increased risk. The site at Scampton is yet to be opened. The Wethersfield and the Bibby Stockholm are accommodating far fewer people than originally planned. It appears inevitable that collectively these early sites will now cost more than the alternative of using hotels. The Home Office plans to develop a coherent strategy for the type and quantity of accommodation it needs are welcome, but it needs to build flexibility because the inherent difficulty of predicting the number of people who might choose to seek asylum and the uncertainty created by the implementation of the Illegal Migration Act. And I would just want to remind everybody about the amount of money that is made through people trafficking and human traffickers. Now, this $150 billion, whatever that is in pounds, is only for forced labour. But as we can see, forced labour is only 38% of the total of the 21 million victims of human trafficking worldwide. 8% is for other, including organ trafficking. But the main section of this is sexual exploitation and many, many children involved in that. Now, we've made the point that the UK government's response to human trafficking is in the total of something around £150 million a year. 150 million, not 150 billion. So, in other words, that 150 million is effectively the cost of doing business. And they're doing nothing through their war program and so on to stop trafficking. They're doing nothing to stop the criminals that are involved in trafficking. It seems to me that if we're going to spend 1.2 billion on accommodating people when they get here, what would happen if we spent 1.2 billion instead of a few million on actually trying to deal with the problem in the first place? And in fact, if we stop the war policy, then perhaps we have a lot more money to do that. Just a thought. Let's just end with the BBC, because this tweet I saw from Concerned Citizen today. BBC can't even tell the truth about the reporter's location. Watch the same vehicles on loop as she is apparently live. Obvious green screen. Legacy media is dead. So we have this little bit of video. We just thought you'd like to see it for a bit of amusement. Watch the background and listen for the horns.
To you, tell us more about what's been happening. Obviously, tension between the two countries running very high in recent times.
Very high, Anita. And of course, in fact, in the last few minutes, we just had confirmation from the foreign ministry here in Pakistan confirming that Pakistan did carry out attacks inside Afghanistan territory. The statement has come saying that this morning Pakistan carried out intelligence-based anti-terrorist operations in the border regions inside Afghanistan. They say that the target of the operations was a particular terrorist group that is responsible, they say, for multiple...
Okay, so you get the point. Now, I'm going to hold our hands up and say, you know, what's behind us may not really be there and so on. And maybe perhaps we could be accused of the same thing. But actually, since we have less than a fraction of 1% of the budget of BBC News, I think that's fair enough. In their case, that is clearly misrepresentation. They've gone quite a bit of effort to persuade everybody that the traffic noise was there and so on. Although the green screen itself was pretty poor. Not that Charles is better than I am. I don't have any hair to have this problem around the edges with. But you know, Vanessa, very quickly, thoughts?
What can I say, really? I mean, it takes me back to, I think it was the start of the SMO in Ukraine, and it was Lindsay Hilsum of Channel 4 who was on a balcony, which could have been virtually anywhere at the time. So, yeah, you know.
Yeah, don't believe anything you see on the BBC. It's basically the thoughts there. Okay, let's leave it there for today. Thank you very much to Vanessa and Charles for being with me today. Thank you all for watching. We'll be back in a few minutes if you're a UK column member for some extra. Otherwise, don't forget the interview at 1 p.m. tomorrow on Fluoride, and we'll see you at 1 p.m. for the news as usual on Friday. See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.